Okay, hi everyone, my name's Queenie and welcome to my talk. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land. We're meeting today on Walamatagal land, Darug land. This land and the land across this continent was never ceded, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present. So my talk is titled Gamifying the Digital Comic, Creative Labour and the Future of Digital Comics in a Neoliberal World. This is a PhD thesis that was just submitted, so this talk will be a summary of the findings. It's also a creative thesis in the discipline of comic studies, meaning that part of the thesis requires some sort of creative production. So it's a thesis in two parts. The first part is the written part, where I address the research topic, which is about the effects of neoliberalism on comic creators, comic production, and how that shapes the digital comics medium through various popular internet platforms. The second half is a creative production, in this case a digital comic game hybrid made in the free game engine Unity. So this section of the thesis is intended to be an activist comic as a sort of a pushback against the aforementioned internet platforms. It does this by contributing its source code to the digital commons and as a tool for a wider community to discuss the effects of neoliberalism. So that means all the source code, music, art is available to download and remix under the Creative Commons license, which is part of the thesis, and I'll explain more about it later on. As of right now, you can download the comic game as an executable file and the source code as a separate file from my website, which is here at queeniechan.com/phd. And so these two parts aren't meant to be looked at separately, but rather as two halves of the same whole. And I'll be explaining how they'll be connected in this talk. Because this is in two parts, the structure of this talk will be divided into several segments as well. It'll start off with a 40-minute talk about the key points in my thesis, and it will be kind of like the greatest hits part, meaning that I'll have to leave a number of things out. So if you're interested in the detailed version, please let me know, and I can send you my thesis. So the core topics will be in comic studies and in neoliberalism and how it shapes the working conditions of comic creators and the format of digital comics, with a focus on the specific format of digital comics known as webtoons, which is originally from South Korea. Then there will be a 10-minute demonstration of my comic game hybrid, and as I give my demonstration, I'll also be explaining why things are presented in a certain way in the game and how that ties in with my written thesis. I'll also talk a bit more about releasing the comic game source code under Creative Commons as an act of resistance in the wider realm of digital comics. And after that, hopefully, we'll have some time for questions. So, okay, before I continue, I'll give a brief introduction to myself and my work. So my name is Queenie Chan, that's my real name. I'm a practicing comic book writer-artist with about 20 years of experience who creates mostly in the style of Japanese manga or a children's illustration style. So a bit more about my background. My family's from Hong Kong, and I migrated to Australia when I was 6 years old. I started drawing manga when I was 18 and was first published, professionally published in 2005 with an American-based publisher called Tokopop. So that book was a series of a three-book series called The Dreaming, which is a supernatural mystery thriller about schoolgirls disappearing in the Australian bush. And after that, I went on to illustrate some comics by best-selling authors Dean Koontz and Kylie Chan. And I also produce a number of fiction and non-fiction works that are self-published. So generally speaking, in regard to comics, you could say my work tends to be for a teen and older audience and leaning towards a majority female audience. I've also worked as a writer-illustrator as well, so I've kind of worked in a variety of roles. And since I've worked so widely in the comics medium, comic studies and comics labor is one of my big interests. Speaking as someone who's so close to the subject matter, it's impossible for me to look at the comics industry through anything but the perspective of a creator. So that kind of informs a lot of my approach, particularly when it comes to the power dynamics that exist when comic creators produce their work, whether they're self-publishing or working with larger institutions. It's something I'm interested in, which I don't think is commonly addressed in comic studies. As we all know, the advent of the internet has radically changed a lot of creative mediums, partly in the format they take in going from print to digital or being transmedia and part of a larger interconnected piece of intellectual property or IP, but also how they're created, published, distributed, consumed, and in the transformation, labor relations between creators and publishers have undergone a lot of upheaval. And that's not even looking at external factors such as the changes currently going on in the world around us, like wars, the 2008 financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now artificial intelligence, or AI. Suffice to say, no creator creates in a vacuum. When comic studies look at comic creators, they tend to look at the creator's output and then analyze the content of these comics. However, they sometimes neglect talking about the wider socioeconomic circumstances that creators create in and how they try to change themselves to fit whatever the market or publishers or readers they're appealing to want. And that's not really the fault of comic scholars, since that kind of information is usually not visible to them. But this is something that I think could do more with some studies in comic studies, and I hope that a practicing comic creator like myself can bring some new perspective to the discussion. So, what is neoliberalism? Before I continue, I thought I'd best take a big picture approach and explain the term neoliberalism, since it's a recurring theme in my thesis. Firstly, neoliberalism is pretty much relevant to everything we do in our society. It's a socio-economic political ideology closely related to the system of capitalism. And it's something of a kind of not-so-well-functioning ideology, if you judge from the viewpoint of the kind of general discontent and malaise in our current society. So neoliberalism has been blamed for a lot of societal ills, everything from our hollowed-out industrial base, our soaring cost of living, massive wealth gap, and so on. And unfortunately, that also makes neoliberalism a kind of controversial term in academia. There's no agreed-upon definition for it in the humanities, and a lot of people have different definitions for what it is and kind of use it in different ways. And nonetheless, whatever the term is meant to describe, the most common narrative can be very broadly framed as some kind of deliberate shift in recent history away from a sort of public collective mindset to that of a private individualized mindset. So one of the ways that neoliberalism can be described is as a capitalist class project, a kind of a deliberate reassertion of ruling class power to strip away a lot of the concessions that labor unions have won for workers since the post-World War II era. So despite all the contradictory definitions, there's still a few main tenets of neoliberalism that I think most academics can agree on. I'll explain what these are in a general sense and talk about how it kind of overlaps with some aspects of capitalism and how a lot of that becomes a rhetorical justification for a lot of the excesses of capitalism that we might be experiencing today. So in this case, I'll be borrowing from Marxist academic David Harvey on how neoliberalism expresses itself. Firstly, it believes in the efficiency of the so-called free market to solve pretty much all the problems. In terms of rhetoric, that means the government has no power to shape the economy because the free market is characterized as a kind of force of nature, like a hurricane or a volcano, and you have to just let it sort itself out. So that ultimately leads to deregulation and the libertarian mindset of how the best government is a very small government. And secondly, neoliberalism believes in the sanctity of individual agency and self-sufficiency. So neoliberalism got its name from classical liberalism, an 18th century political philosophy that focused on the limits of government power and towards the freedom of the individual and the kind of paradoxical role of the government in managing this permissible freedom. So eventually it partnered with capitalism and European colonialism, and this era of history also saw the decline of feudalism and the rise of the so-called freed man, who freed from the feudal system is now free to buy and sell private property. And this eventuates in the rise of mass consumerism and mass consumerist culture in the 20th century. And I think this is epitomized by Margaret Thatcher's 1987 quote that there are individual men and women, and there are families, and there's no such thing as society. And that quote's actually longer, but I paraphrase. So thirdly, under neoliberalism, all aspects of life can be privatized and reduced to units of profitability. So this is a drive that overlaps with the cumulative nature of capitalism. And so neoliberalism then becomes a rhetoric that the capitalist class uses to justify the endless accumulation of wealth by them, and also the continual global expropriation of wealth, typically through US imperialism. And finally, there's no alternative to the system. Neoliberalism is all-encompassing and it's inescapable. So same as the previous point. So basically, we're all enmeshed in this system of neoliberalism. It all shapes us, whether we want it to or not, and whether we know it or not. Okay, so wherefore that leaves the digital comics creator. How do they live and work in this neoliberal digital world? And for the purpose of my thesis, I focused exclusively on digital comics, in particular webtoons. And unlike traditional print comics, which follow the layout of a printed page, it's a vertically scrolling comics format that is created specifically for the smartphone screen. So you can see here up on the slide is that on the left-hand side is traditional comics that I drew. It's meant to be printed in a book format, so it's kind of a page dimensions and the ratio of it is shaped a certain way, whereas on the right-hand side is a webtoon, and it's meant to be very thin, and you're meant to read through it. And it's in a kind of a constantly finger-flicking kind of way. So webtoons is typically one long story divided into multiple short episodes, which gears it towards bite-sized reading. It's characterized by large gaps between each panels and having large text, and you read it by rapidly scrolling with your fingers like you're speed reading on your phone. So I study it because it's currently the most popular and accessible form of digital comics in the Western world, and not counting pirated works that are all over the internet, and because that can't be accurately quantified, and also because it's somewhat understudied in Anglophone comic studies, which is a problem I'll explain a bit more later on. So here I draw on my own personal experience as a working comic creator and also from some of the creators I know. So let's ask a question. If I was a creator looking to create a digital comic, what would be my considerations and how and where would I start? Well, first of all, creating a comic is a lot of work. It's a very, very labor-intensive job. It's much more labor-intensive than, say, writing prose, and it's also typically the work of the solo creator or a small group of people at most. So unlike video games or film that can have small teams of people or massive teams of people working on it, even very popular and successful comics typically don't go beyond a small group of people. And this is something that modern technology has yet to change much. There's already a fair amount of digital drawing tools, software aids, and 3D models that's being used in creating comics. Webtoons, generally speaking, actually already uses a fair amount of pre-rendered 3D backgrounds. You can see some of it here in the slide on the webtoon on the right. However, that doesn't seem to have really changed the time and effort it takes to create comics. Not to mention that the tastes of modern readers usually demand this polished, hand-drawn look, because that's usually what they're used to. So drawing comics is also a very isolating job with kind of questionable financial returns, because while a few superstars can make a lot of money in comics, should you make it through the magic portal and become a big hit, but many creators work just as hard and their work don't sell as well. And nearly all comic creators are also freelancers, and that's regardless of what market they work in, even when they work in some kind of institutionalized framework. And the closest equivalent to this would be the Japanese manga industry. Currently, I would characterize that industry as kind of like the Hollywood of comics, where the most amount of comics are produced and sold, even those very successful creators in that system tends to be freelancers. So it's safe to argue that comic creators, before they start creating anything substantial rather than just for fun, which is a separate category of people that I don't really address, they have to consider monetary returns. And in the internet age where you create digital comics, your first concern is where you should post your comics online to gain an audience. And the hope is that eventually, if you get enough views, you could somehow parlay these free views into paying customers, which some people have done, though the threshold of that is impossible to predict and constantly changing. Until that happens, if it ever happens, all the financial, emotional, and health costs of creating comics tend to be borne by the creators because, let's face it, the readers are often, sometimes they're interested, but typically they're not. A lot of casual readers in that. So, most creators need to find an audience as soon as possible in the hope of gaining their monetary returns. For that, they tend to post on large internet platforms where a lot of readers gather because there's very little other way to get readers. And so that leads to a situation where the comic creator, before they even put pencil to paper, will start thinking about how they may shape their comic to fit tastes and requirements of whatever platform they're looking to post on. Because if you don't conform to that platform's requirements and their audience, your digital comic isn't going to get traction, which means that it's not going to get seen or read due to the nature of the way algorithms work. For example, if you want to do comics in the traditional print page format and you want to post on webtoons, you actually will not get traction on that platform because the algorithm won't promote you, and creators understand that. So creators know that if you want to put your work on the webtoons platform, you have to kind of create in that vertical scrolling format. And because webtoons want to promote that format, because that's what they're known for, and that format originates from South Korea, where most webtoon companies are based. And so here we see the importance of talking about neoliberalism and how that overarching system can shape comic creators and even the future format and the medium of digital comics. Because these big internet comic platforms are typically owned by large multinational corporations. Webtoons.com, for example, is owned by Naver, which is a South Korean equivalent of Google and a listed company on the Korean Stock Exchange. And they are looking to get listed in America as well. So that's something that's going to be happening in the next year or so. And being giant corporations in a neoliberal world dealing with individual creators, you could see the unequal labor relations that characterize traditional print publishing in the pre-internet era reappearing. And it's ironic because one of the most utopian proclamations of the early internet was that the internet is a democratizing force. And previously, creators had to deal with gatekeepers of traditional print media who only published creators who conform to whatever political, aesthetic, or moral requirements, etc., that a publisher has. And the argument was that the internet freed creators from traditional gatekeepers by allowing them to publish and reach an audience of their own by meritocratic means. And unfortunately, as the internet became more dominated by big corporations and internet platforms, the spaces for grassroots independent creators shrink. And it's because it costs time and money to set up a website of your own, and if you get substantial traffic, the costs can actually get pretty enormous. So usually it means that the same unequal power dynamics that existed between creators and traditional print publishing is now reproduced in the digital realm, with some key differences. Well, first of all, the internet is transnational and global, so creators are no longer just in competition with the local. The competition is now global. With globalization comes the unmooring of cultures from their place of origin, leading into convergence and homogeneity. Everything kind of looks the same after a while as creators try and copy each other on that platform. And lastly, with a transnational labor force comes exploitative practices that are sovereign countries with their own localized labor laws can't really enforce on multinational corporations. So that if a webtoon creator that relies and creates on a South Korean platform has been exploited in some way, and they have no real legal recourse, especially if they're from the global south. So how do we conceive of the ways neoliberalism shapes these comic platforms, which in turn shapes the creators and their output? Well, there's a number of ways by which capitalism can express itself in the information age, which is digital capitalism, and we're going to examine a framework that I think is relevant to digital comics, which is platform capitalism. But before I talk about this form of digital capitalism, I also want to talk a bit more about webtoons and its history to give a better context of how this format became globally dominant and popular. And I also want to talk briefly about comic studies and how it regards webtoons and digital comics in general. Okay, so let's talk briefly about Anglophone comic studies regarding webtoons. Well, the trouble with comic studies is that it rarely talks about webtoons, actually. In fact, up until 2017 and COVID, it rarely mentioned digital comics at all. And that's because comic studies in English-speaking countries is a marginalized discipline. Until recently, Anglophone cultures looked down on comics as a juvenile medium. So unlike other countries that have had more cultural history with comics as an art form, like France or Japan, and now South Korea, Anglophone comic studies is kind of small and recent in comparison. Suffice to say, there's only a handful of books and articles on digital comics and webtoons. And the second problem with talking about digital comic studies is that there's actually no set definition for what a digital comic is. There isn't for comics as well, but digital comics kind of further complicates this lack of a definition for comics. So to many people, a digital comic is the ebook edition of a print comic, but that's not always true. The webtoon's vertical scrolling format that I showed previously is an example of something that is just not a replication of the printed page. There's also the digital comics out there that combine sound, animation, interactivity, augmented reality, virtual reality, ludic elements, which are game-like elements, and so on. So in fact, what counts as a digital comics is so broad and so ill-defined that some comics academics don't think digital comics is actually comics. They think it's a completely different medium, and that's up for debate. Nobody's kind of argued in either direction definitively. And likewise, webtoons as a website has also experimented with technology on their platform, such as music, multimedia, AR, and VR. It didn't catch on with audiences at this point in time, but these experimentations exist, and the big South Korean webtoon platforms has these creative tools for their Korean users to create such mixed media stories. So suffice to say that webtoon platforms aren't just dominating the digital comic space, they are actively creating technological platforms that they own where they're looking to shape the next iteration of digital comics, which is whatever it might be. Now, within a neoliberal context, this is a little concerning because neoliberalism dictates that companies make profits, and it also creates unequal relationships between these institutions and creators. So it might not be a huge surprise to people that even though Webtoons is owned by Naver, which is South Korean Google, like I said before, the government of South Korea is also somewhat involved in its overseas expansion. There's an element that some people don't really know about South Korean pop culture in general. And a lot of it is actually being pushed by the South Korean government as part of their government policy. What they call the Korean Wave, which includes popular music like K-pop, K-drama, and webtoons, amongst other cultural products from South Korea, is not really an organically occurring grassroots thing that happened to get popular online. It's part of a larger government-led initiative to globalize Korea's creative industries and enhance the standing of Korean-produced cultural products overseas. So for the Korean government, it's an attempt at what they call soft power, which is a geopolitical strategy to promote the standing of a country in the global community through cultural influence, rather than through hard power, what they say, which is probably military kind of domination. Okay, so this kind of explains the way webtoons function within the South Korean pop culture ecosystem, not as an individual industry, but as one part of a vast interconnected network of creative industries that include movies, music, merchandising, games, and so on. And so that, of course, the transmedia aspect of it kicks in. Webtoons that gets popular, gets spun through a lot of other creative industries. Is that if a webtoon's popular, they make movies out of it, they do music and prose fiction, video games, and so on and so forth. And these all things are meant to create synergy between each other and make money and corral audiences and fans of that particular intellectual property into consuming all these other variations of it. So you could say that webtoons, both as a format, an internet platform, as an industry, is actually embedded within a much larger cultural sphere that is pushed by the government for political reasons. And you might say, well, what's the problem? This isn't unique to South Korea. Japan actually has the same thing going on with anime, manga, video games, and they started it in the 60s with their media mix strategy, which does more or less a similar thing. So I wouldn't really call it a problem per se, but it does mean that webtoons as a global internet platform isn't free of political influences. Because of the nature of the Korea Wave initiative, webtoons as a platform is going to be incentivized to promote Korean creators and their works above that of other creators. So it does mean that whether you're a reader or a creator on the webtoon platform, Korean creators would probably be pushed first by the algorithm. So therefore, again, success on webtoons may not be as much as a meritocracy or a popularity contest as some people might believe it to be. So okay, what does that mean when it comes to Naver's webtoon website? Well, it means that Naver as a company is not really doing business in the same way traditional comic publishers do. In fact, webtoons and Naver isn't a comics publisher at all. You may argue that webtoons publishes and hosts digital comics for people to read, so therefore it counts as a publisher. But Facebook also publishes comics from its users, and no one's going to say that Facebook is a comics publisher. So from that logic, companies like Facebook, Google, and Naver are actually technology companies and not publishers in any traditional sense. And so what webtoons actually is, the webtoons.com website, it is a platform. So we're now going to talk about the capitalist framework that webtoons operates under, platform capitalism. So platform capitalism refers to the intersection between neoliberalism and digital capitalism. And the term was popularized by Nick Cernicek in 2016. I'm sorry if I butchered that name. So his definition of it says that the decline of industrial capitalism in the West has caused the rise of a new service-driven information economy. And this changed what the drivers of production is, which originally was the industrial machines that made things, but now is actually information. So in an information economy, the source of wealth is information, and it's made by collecting it and reselling it. And according to this theory, this is how tech companies like Facebook, Google, and thereby Naver make their money. They harvest, analyze, repackage, and resell user information at a higher price, and that is their business model. And to do that, they use the underlying physical network infrastructure that make up the internet, and they also do it using software platforms. So what exactly is the definition of a platform? Well, according to Cernicek, a platform is at its most basic level, can be defined as digital infrastructure, which allow two or more people the means to interact, typically through the form of a marketplace. And sometimes tools are also offered to allow users to build and offer their own services to others. So this gives a platform owners a unique ability to collect all points of data that is generated on the network and any info on its users. And they can then resell that information to advertisers to make money, and they can also block certain people from the platform or manipulate the algorithm to privilege certain individuals over others for whatever reason that they choose. They can also make money by charging a fee whenever a user spends money on that platform, though that is not really their main driver of revenue. Since platforms make money through gathering and reselling the data of its users, a platform is something that gains power through size. That is the economies of scale that happens when you have a huge number of people connected to a particular network. For example, a social media platform like Facebook may have the same setup, but it's pretty much useless if there's only like 10 people on it. But with, say, if there was a billion people on Facebook, that is highly useful, since that means that you have 1 billion nodes of data that you can collect, and that's collecting data of 1 billion people, so that is much more valuable. And you can use your ownership of that network to influence these people in ways that they're not aware of. So for that reason, tech companies that own platforms have one primary objective. They have to keep existing users and they have to get new users because that's the source of their income. And the way they do that is by providing services for free and owning multiple platforms at the same time, a process that's called cross-subsidization. So for example, Google provides Google Search to you for free, and then they offer you Google Mail, Google Maps, Google Calendar, YouTube, and so on and so forth. So likewise, Naver provides Webtoons for people to read for free, but as a company, they also own a website called Wattpad, which is a user-generated prose fiction platform site that started in the West, and a number of other similar platforms, you know, that do business in similar areas. And the point of this is to expand the user place, the user base of its existing platforms by pooling all these user bases of multiple platforms together, and so that individual users can have their online movement tracked across different websites. As they move across these websites, the same company can track them like Google does with its platforms. So from that perspective, the business model of a company like Naver is far more expansive than just Webtoons. To them, Webtoons maybe comics and Wattpad, maybe prose fiction, but they're all the same thing to a tech company like Naver. They're just content. They're all just places to get users into the network to harvest data on them. So as you might expect from that kind of business model, platforms also have a drive to monopolization. And it's an example of how they're a digital expression of neoliberalism, because as I said earlier, one of the tenets of neoliberalism is there is no escaping this system. Webtoons doesn't aim to be just a platform to read and upload digital comics. Its aim is to be the platform to read and upload digital comics. And in doing so, they're actually able to subsume both the professional and the amateur spheres of digital comics on the same website. So in the print era, people who are shut out by publishing gatekeepers have to self-publish and build their own communities away from these print publishers or whatever institutions they try to get into. This means that when someone does find success in these kind of amateur markets, they can be very successful on their own without relying on a publisher or being part of these traditional print networks. But in the era of platforms, both the amateurs and the professionals, they end up on the same website competing with each other, separated only by a tab up the top. So here you have a slide showing that the Webtoons website, which is webtoons.com, this is the pro section and it's called Originals. If you look up on the top left-hand side there, you see the Originals word. And then the amateur section is the Canvas section, which is here. You can see that it's just, there's Canvas up top, you click on it and this is the amateur section. So this situation puts the creators at a disadvantage, whether you're a paid Webtoons original creator or an amateur posting comics on Canvas. In theory, how it's supposed to work on Webtoons is that you start by posting in the Canvas section, and once you get a certain number of followers and views, you get turned into an original paid creator. However, that process is completely arbitrary, and I don't know what the threshold is. No one knows. And if you look at many of the Canvas creators, some of them have more views than the creators on the originals. Like some of them, these have millions of views, but they're not on originals. Who knows why? Some have said they wanted to be, others don't care, but it's impossible to tell. It is completely arbitrary. So the monopoly nature of Webtoons means that anybody looking to post a digital comic will likely choose to do it on Webtoons because that's where the readers are. Okay, and unfortunately, because everyone's doing it, that leads to oversaturation on the Canvas platform, meaning that creators can't really rely on Webtoons to promote them. So they have to go outside of Webtoons to their own social networks to drive traffic to their own Webtoons. So this does several things. Firstly, it lets Webtoons get free content that they would otherwise have to pay for. Creators post comics there for free because that's where the readers are, and some are eventually hoping to become original creators and get paid, though not all of them are. I have to be clear about that. Some people just do this for fun. And secondly, Webtoons get free readers, free new readers to mine for data on their platforms, and that's because creators who post there can only get visibility if they advertise their Webtoons on their own dime, somewhere away from Webtoons. Thirdly, if a creator gains traction on Webtoons, their success will be tied to the platform. And it's quite hard for the creator to leave that platform since the bulk of their readership are from there. So likewise, the fact that Webtoons is geared towards the vertical scrolling format and not the traditional print comics format means that if a creator is popular, they can't easily take their Webtoons to a print publisher without redoing parts of it and doing a lot more work on that. But of course, if your work isn't in the vertical scrolling format, Webtoons won't promote your work in the algorithm, and you definitely won't be picked for their original section. So what else can Webtoons do with this digital comics platform? Well, due to the monopoly that Webtoons have on digital comics, it puts them in a very good position to shape the future of digital comics. And now I've mentioned there's no set definition of digital comics. It can be a Webtoon, but it can have sound, music, multimedia, etc. And it's an open space for people to experiment. And Webtoons has already done experiments in this area. It hasn't caught on, but if something does catch on, Webtoons will be in a very good position to shape and own the underlying software and possibly even the format of whatever this hypothetical digital comic format is going to be and whatever it looks like. Now, if this happens, neoliberalism and platform capitalism ensures that Webtoons isn't really doing it for the sake of developing an artistic medium or for the rights of individual creators. They'll be doing it to ensure that they will own and they will shape and profit off this new format. And that does suggest that the future of digital comics, whatever form it takes, is up for shaping not by creators and artists of a medium, but possibly by a tech company looking to own the underlying software tools of the format. So, how do we push back against that? How do we push back against multinationals working within a neoliberal world geared towards privatization of profits, trying to dominate, I wouldn't say they're trying to dominate, but looking to dominate the development of a particular medium? How do we resist this situation is the question I'm asking. Now, it's questionable that one person doing a PhD, you know, can actually affect any kind of amazing change in this world, but a symbolic act, I think, can be a useful one. And so in terms of the problems with the digital comic space that I pointed out in my thesis, I attempted a solution that can be characterized as an act of resistance, and that's my creative thesis. So now we move on to my creative work, the portion of my thesis where I created a comic game hybrid. The goal of this creative part is to create an alternative form of digital comics that is different to the Webtoon format that can stake a claim on the landscape of digital comics by using an open source model of creation. This comic game is created in Unity, free game engine, so there is some overlap with game development, but it's also licensed under Creative Commons that allows for redistribution and remixing. And part of the thesis itself involves releasing this source code to the public, and that the point of that is so they can create their own versions if they want. Before I continue, I have to explain the basis of Creative Commons license it uses, which was created by Lawrence Lessig in the early 2000s, and I'll explain what the commons is. The commons is a concept that was around before capitalism and is meant to be the natural and cultural resources that should be accessible to all members of society. So things that are in the public domain is an example of the commons, though that too is increasingly under attack currently. So Lessig's goal was to create a special license and a two-tiered economy when creators can choose to put their own work into the sharing economy, it's so open source, or in the commercialized economy. In practice, it's a pushback against a neoliberal tendency toward privatizing all aspects of life and by bringing back the concept of the commons. So in this case, it's expanding the digital commons, which is an open source basis of the early internet before it became so commercialized. And so in this neoliberal age, expanding the digital commons is also an act of resistance against this kind of hegemonic nature of platform capitalism. So that means my previous act, you know, is more, in terms of a creative thesis, is more of a thesis by process rather than content. The content, in my opinion, isn't really the core focus, though it's geared towards something that I hopefully can interest as many people in as possible. Originally, it would have made more sense if I had made a comic game that is actually about a comic creator getting, you know, entangled in this whole platform capitalism matrix, but had I made such a thing, I thought that it wouldn't actually see much of a reach due to the extremely limited audience it would have, since only comic creators would understand something like that. So I think the goal of activism and resistance is to create as great a reach as possible. So instead, I decided to use an existing digital comic called On a Plate, which is a 4-page comic by Toby Morris from 2015 that addressed wealth privilege, to use as a case study and as a starting block for how I do my comic hybrid, a comic game hybrid. So it's a simple comic that went viral, that was about a topic that ordinary people can relate to, so I decided to do something similar. And so here's the original comic. It's 4 pages, which starts with 2 identical looking babies, one from a well-off family and the other from a struggling family. It shows them going through their lives, with the wealthy one benefiting off their wealth and the other not so much, and culminating in a final panel that shows the obliviousness of the wealthy character to their own original, to their own privilege. So if you want to read that entire comic in a bit more detail, because the screen doesn't show it great here, so there's a link at the bottom. If you can always find it on Google quite easily, since it's a very popular comic. So this is a very effective comic, and very short, about the accumulative nature of capitalism and how that gives a lot of privilege to the people in that bubble. And the only criticism I could level at it is that it really only addresses wealth inequality due to its short length. And I think these sort of things need to be short, because otherwise you could just bang on and on about a topic and drive people away from being a bit too lecturing with the way you talk. So I thought that I could do something similar, but with the issues of race and gender involved as well. So in other words, I wanted to address intersectionality with my comic game and create situations where the world not only reacts differently based on class, but on skin tone and gender as well. So that it means experimenting with branching narratives, which is a durable thing, since a game engine gives me a much broader swath of functionality to work with. So this hybrid is an attempt to get people to consider the issues of class, skin tone, and gender as interconnected rather than separate, which in terms of the public discourse tends to be a thing these days. And now, so there are some big limitations of the project. Firstly, it's what I was able to program on my own, and I'm not a great programmer. So it's not the most user-friendly thing out there, nor is Unity easy to work with. And the small amount of scenarios being presented is quite limited, due to it being a PhD project with a limited time and budget. And there's a whole range of experiences that it doesn't address, like queer experiences, disability, immigrants, wards of the state, etc. And it also doesn't address the super rich, the homeless, or even the middle class. And likewise, I wrote this hybrid from the perspective of an upper middle class Asian woman doing a PhD. So it's a very limited perspective from my end. And I wouldn't say there's a lot of authenticity to some of the situations that happened in this story, simply because I'll never be in that kind of situation. And that's partly why I've released the source code of the game to the public. I'm aware of these limitations. I expect other people to look at this and think that they can do a way better job. So I want to give them the tools to be able to do that. And hopefully some of the scenarios in this game can galvanize some kind of dialogue between different communities of people. And so people are free to download the game source code and rewrite all the dialogue, or you know, do whatever they want to reflect something that they feel is a bit more truer to their lives, or whatever it is they want to do, and that's part of the point. So now I'll give a walkthrough of the game and talk about some of the choices I made in creating and what was surprising to me during the process. So now I'll get to show you the game itself. Okay, fantastic. So the game just loads typically on this screen. It's supposed to be a blank screen without even the title, and that's because I didn't want people who just stumble onto this game to have any preconceptions of what is going on here. And so only when you replay this game, unfortunately, because it's on my own laptop, there's that problem, you will see the title. And so it just encourages you to enter your name, which I'll enter as Queenie, and this notice is just down here all the time. Okay. So there is sound to go with this. Okay, I'll just turn it down so that the recording doesn't get weird. So there is a bit of sound going on with this game, but it's mostly background music, so I'll just turn it down. So this is a character selection screen, and it's unlike most character selection screens, because while you could choose, you know, how you want to configure your character, you can make them, and you move using the arrow keys, you could choose whether you'd be wealthy or poor, and you could also choose your gender. And this is quite crudely depicted, in my opinion, you know, using a color scheme. And so this kind of goes, if you want to be male, and if you want to be female. And the reason why I chose it to depict it as a corridor is that, you know, it is a spectrum. And if you want to identify as non-binary, you can. You could choose the E. If you press the E button, you could actually become non-binary in this game. And so I'll just choose wealthy. And you could also choose the skin tone of the character. And here is also presented as a corridor. where you can have a range of skin tones. Because I'm aware this game is limited, there's only a certain way that I can present these things, and this is my way of showing that, look, I understand that these things are actually a spectrum. I am deliberately forced to present it as a binary choice when in fact it isn't. So, which is why I visually presented it that way. So I'll just choose to be a wealthy, dark-skinned female. And I just want to mention that I didn't actually use any words in this opening sequence. I expect people to figure out on their own what it is I'm trying to say. And most people will eventually figure it out from next screen anyway. And the reason for that is that I want to avoid using any actual terms. Like in talking about this, I have to use these terms of rich, poor, you know, male, female, and skin tone, which I don't use the term race in my thesis or here. In this talk, because I feel that sort of thing is kind of a bit too Americanized, so I want to make this a bit more broader, so I just use skin tone here. Yep. So I hope that visually the game can speak for itself. So it goes into the opening, which is where you are born into a hospital and two parents, and the parents themselves are randomized in the term of configuration that they are. This is a heterosexual couple from a well-off background, because that's what I chose. But I also want to point out that there are variations of different kinds of parents too. There's single parents, single mum, single dad, lesbian parents, gay parents, but these are all decided by a randomized dice roll, so there's no saying what you might get. And then you get your life partner, which, if you refer back to Toby Morris's comic strip, it is the parallel person. And this person's characteristics will be randomly generated. Typically, it's going to be the polar opposite of you, but there's actually 95% of that happening. There's a 5% chance of it actually will be someone from either a similar background, but with one or two differences. What it won't do is randomly choose someone who is from the exact same background as you. Okay, so this is somebody, Kurt, you know, a randomly generated name, you know, that is from a different background to you. So the game begins in a hospital, where I guess much like the Toby Morris's strip, it makes the point that whatever disadvantages you have from a poorer background is going to be, it's going to pretty much start when you were born. And at certain points in time, I'm going to speed through this game because it gives a chance for people to ask questions at the end. So the point about this game is that at certain points in these, as the story progresses, you're going to be presented with randomized number choices where you get to roll a dice and see what happens. So here what it says is that you're in a hospital, and due to crowded public hospitals, you have a higher chance of catching an illness. And if you are from a wealthier background, you have a lower chance of that happening to you. And so this is a representation. Oh, I guess everybody gets sick. Okay, so you do get a status effect if you get sick like that. And the chances of you getting certain kind of status ailments, whether it's health or because you're in debt, is a lot more common if you are from a poorer background than if you are from a rich background. So when that happens, you will get some kind of visual signifier that blocks you from reading the strip properly, or should I say looking at the art properly, because at first I thought in this game, if I wanted to create something that showed the kind of difficulties of being a someone from a poorer background, maybe you could have stats like they do in video games talking about what your, you know, health and debt stats are, but then I thought it actually means nothing within the context of a comic strip, because it doesn't change a thing, it's just a bar on the side. So I thought if I could obscure the reader's experience, you know, it might be a better representation of what it actually is like to be from a poorer background, since it's such a difficulty in life. So at various points in time, you would see vertical columns kind of descend on the comic, where it kind of overlaps both the top and the bottom layer of the screen. And the reason for that is that there are some situations in life that are universal, whether it's a parent getting an illness, or maybe something terrible happening to you, like you're getting burglarized and things like that, or maybe it's some giant natural disaster. All of these are things that could happen in this game. Yep. So this game starts off, and again, wealthy people, they tend to have an easier time with education and all that. And so it kind of goes through this these two people's early lives. And again, this is a branching narrative that happens, in that there are certain things that can happen. Oh, this is interesting. So it's gone into the crime narrative. So there are five situations that could happen here. And This is the crime one. So there's an incident that could happen. Okay, nothing happens. And so there could be a situation with police profiling that could happen if you end up in a neighborhood that has issues of high crime. Okay, so the thing about the crime thing, and it's interesting how it's played out here, is that when it comes to police profiling, generally understand dark-skinned people to be more likely to be police profiled. But typically it's men only. The vast majority of police profiling happens to men. And of course it happened to dark-skinned men a lot more than they do to light-skinned men. But it's most interesting that when I was writing this scenario is that the people who get police profiled the most are actually wealthy black men. Because it's presumed that a lot of wealthy black men who are living in wealthier suburbs with lighter-skinned people, then you kind of stand out and so you attract that kind of police attention. Now, this is a way that I chose to write this scenario, not saying that there aren't multiple ways to live as a dark-skinned, you know, male that is from a wealthy background, but this is just something that I thought was interesting to point out, in that police profiling could happen in a huge variety of ways depending on what kind of person you are. And so in this case, nothing much happens to the light-skinned character, and so on. So this is just two stages, this particular game, and so you graduate, and based on what happened in your previous life, there are certain rates for what kind of level of education you end up with, and so on and so forth. So I won't continue in this game because I think we don't have much time left. So I think the game ends with a natural disaster. Again, this is one of those universal things that happens to everyone. And ultimately, I think when it comes to the issues of the wealth gap, the people who get most affected, even though everyone gets affected in the event of a nationwide disaster, people who usually get affected the most are often people from a poorer background because they have less, I guess, resources to dig themselves back out again when something universal happens to everyone. And this is a game that argues that, you know, capitalism is accumulative and wealth confers untold privileges that most people are not aware of in their everyday lives. So anyway, that concludes my presentation. If you want to play the game, you're free to download it off my website. I've posted here, you know, queeniechan.com/PhD. There are plans to give it a wider release because I just handed in my PhD, so I know it needs to be distributed with a thesis. So I just like to get my thesis marked first before I do too much with it. So thank you for attending this talk. Let me know if you have any questions. You could buy it at queeniechan.com and you can buy it on any online store. So if you go to Booktopia in Australia, you can go to Booktopia, Amazon, and you could just get my works there.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask a little bit more about, had you done Choose Your Own Adventure comics before? And I guess I'm sort of interested in how doing this as a game rather than just as a comic first sort of changed how you're thinking about the comics and how.
Yeah, Choose Your Own Adventure comics is something that has been done by other people. Like, if you're talking about Choose Your Own comic books, you know, as in Choose Your Own Adventure books, those have been around since the 80s, but they're prose. In terms of comics, I haven't seen anyone do it in book form because it is really, you know, it is just not the best way to present it. What I have seen in terms of Choose Your Own comics, Choose Your Own Adventure comics, is by Scott McCloud, who in the early noughties kind of theorized the idea of the infinite canvas. So he was a comic creator who got into the digital age early, and he theorized that we are now liberated from the confines of the page. So he says that now you could have a computer screen that is an infinite canvas, and so you could do a horizontal comic strip and then do another different vertical comic strip that kind of intersects with the first one, and then so you have multiple branching narratives and things like that. But the thing about doing this particular form of comics in the infinite canvas thing is that it's not really Choose Your Own Adventure. And so since then, there have been other attempts in digital comics at doing Choose Your Own Adventure, but most of these are in HTML format. Now, I thought this is perfectly fine, but I thought for what I wanted to do, the randomized number generation aspect of it is important. Like the whole dice rolling thing, as you can see, determining what aspects of your, you know, where you're going to end up in life, I thought that was key to the way that this hybrid presented itself and its stories, that, you know, you could do the exact same thing, you know, in a particular situation, but the outcome becomes completely different, and that's the circumstances of your birth. That's where it begins. You know, so that's the argument. So because of the random number generation aspect, it's a ludic thing. It is a related to game mechanics, and so I thought, you know, a game engine like Unity is probably best suited to presenting that sort of thing. Because I'm not really sure how you can do this in HTML, because I felt I needed to... you need a lot more programming that I don't think HTML, as the way I understand it, provides. And whereas something like a game engine easily provides, because that is what game engines are set up to do. Random number generation is just one very small part of game development. Yep, so that's why I chose to do it in Unity, because it does also give me the chance to expand on other things as well, apart from the random number thing.
Did that change how you were thinking about, I guess you got to sort of create a sort of scenario or sort of your planning where the reader's going to go? Did it change how you were approaching that comic?
Yeah, it did, because it made all the situations expandable, and it made me and allowed me to manipulate what I wanted more in some cases happening and less so in others. For example, police profiling thing, a lot of it's randomly generated, you know, whether you end up with whatever attitude that you get towards the police. Because the thing about, if you get police profiled in the game and you are a dark-skinned, wealthy male, later on, if you do end up getting burglarized, that's a 33% chance of that happening. Very often it doesn't happen, but if you do happen, then if you are a poor dark-skinned male and you underwent the same thing, you will refuse to contact the police because you don't think the police will help you. But no matter how many times you've been police profiled as a wealthy dark-skinned male, you still go to the police. And the reason for that is that the police in a capitalist society is meant to protect wealthy people. You know, so even if you're a dark-skinned wealthy black man, if you're under and you've undergone the kind of humiliation of police profiling, you will still understand that the police is meant to protect your status as a wealthy person in society. So that's how capital is a statement of how capitalist societies function in terms of its police force. Yeah, but that scenario might not happen at all if you don't get the right kind of random number general things. And so some people might disagree with that, and I'm like, that's okay. I'm making a statement through this RNG thing, and if you don't agree, you can actually download the game, redo all the, you know, statistics for who gets what, and it's like, yeah, you can make your own argument against that, and I think that's fine. The whole point of this is to engender debate, and as I talk about, create a situation where people can actually use this to talk about, well, I disagree with this because X, Y, Z, and you can put out your own version if that's what you think.
Well, I was going to say that's the most fascinating thing for me from what you've been talking about is the fact that, you know, you can share this with users, that it's open source, that you're able to do it yourself. So I was thinking maybe this is a bit more of a comment, long-winded thing, but I teach you know, on Netflix, and we look at some of the branch narrative games that are on Netflix, right?
Oh, really?
They're kind of, you know, so they're film scenarios, but every mm-hmm. so often you get a choice, which is you send you down a different path and you can go back and replay the game.
Mm-hmm.
But the really interesting thing is that scholars found, looking at that, scholars and critics have found that Netflix then, in these games which give the illusion of choice, which is the whole thing behind Netflix as a platform, you have all of these infinite choices of things you can watch, but of course there's a, you know, system that you can't control. In these games, the choices that you make are then become data points, essentially,
mm-hmm.
for Netflix to then go, okay,
yeah,
you prefer this kind of show to that kind of show, or this kind of character, and they just take all the information and then use it to create more programs. It's all algorithmic.
Yes.
But, like, very different to what you're doing, but I just...
Well, it's actually very similar, because, like I was talking earlier about platform capitalism, Netflix is a platform.
Right.
And so Netflix, they've actually publicly mentioned that they're competing with sleep. You know, when you're talking about Netflix and who their main competition is, well, their main competition, they've publicly said, is sleep, because they want you to be, if you're going to be looking at a screen, they want it to be Netflix,
mm-hmm.
and you be doing things on Netflix, so they can further data mine you and then resell your information to other kind of platforms and companies to shape you into a better consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nature of everything that Netflix does. And so it's actually pretty relevant to what I was talking about when it comes to webtoons.
Yeah, but your game is actually putting agency back.
Yeah, it is a pushback against these. Well, Netflix has yet to produce tools like YouTube to try and get people to upload their content.
Right.
And I'm not sure if Netflix stuff, when it's bad, it's certainly bad enough to be, you know, created by me with, you know, my phone and all that. But the point is that YouTube has actually generated tools for people to create their own kind of movies to upload. And when that happens, you are kind of dependent on their tools. They do expect you to kind of wed your content to their platform so that your content, because it becomes kind of intertwined with their software platform and you can't extricate it to actually resell elsewhere. And that is the nature of platforms that provide these kind of software tools for people to mess around with. It's like, oh, you know, I'm so generous. I'm letting you guys be creative. But there is an ulterior motive there. And that's what I'm, you know... concerned with when it comes to something like webtoons, is that they are in a prime position to shape the future of digital comics. Not saying that they've actually done that, because nothing they've done is actually caught on, but they're certainly trying. And one day, given the way that this medium would evolve, it already has a fair amount of overlap with video gaming. Now, where does that lead? I don't know. So far, what I've seen, the complaints through the webtoons AR/VR stuff is that the creators, the actual content creators, say that it's too hard for me to use. The tools are too complicated, I need programming skills, I don't get it, you know, but one day people will eventually figure it out. And so this is kind of almost like preempting that sort of thing from happening, because I do think it is concerning, because if it's something that's popular, they could actually copyright that format as well. So even if you had a different software platform, you can't actually recreate that platform, because they might have done something too copyrighted, and then that particular format becomes even further wedded to that pre-existing platform. And this is a process that's happening all over, you know, the internet, based on a lot of the way that these platforms operate. And so you know, we still talk about how free the internet is, but that was 20 years ago. Now we're beginning to see more and more and more of these companies just kind of take up real estate and just stay there permanently. And that is the drive of neoliberalism, is that it has to privatize everything. So these platforms kind of battle each other for total you know, full spectrum dominance of your waking hours. You know, that's what they look to do. Did you have a question?
Yes. My research is also very similar in the
sense
that it kind of critiques Western neoliberal ideas of beauty in mainstream Hindi cinema, which is Bollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my data collection in Mumbai,
mm-hmm.
and I was talking to cultural producers in Bollywood, and they said, you need neoliberalism to sustain the industry. You need money from these capitalist organizations, from these MNCs and beauty brands to sustain. So it's in mainstream popular culture, it's very difficult to actually critique it, because
mm-hmm.
first of all, it will be very difficult to fund these films. Secondly,
yeah.
people will not watch it, because
mm-hmm.
they are ideologically tuned to like things which are more mainstream, which is basically fair skin, thin women, long hair. So I wanted to understand that in digital, does the digital space, digital comics and games offer more scope to create counterculture to capitalism? And what are the different ways to sustain it? If you are actually critiquing capitalism, what are the ways of sustaining it?
Well, that's actually a really, really good question. In terms of webtoons, I'll see if I can actually load the website up. In terms of its... in terms of the website,
yeah.
Oh, actually, I don't think I have internet. Oh, well, you could go on webtoons.com and have a look at the originals yourself. Because, like I said earlier, Webtoons is a South Korean platform, and so it kind of has a tendency towards what South Koreans think is beautiful. And if you look at the Webtoons originals, it is very actually heavily dominated by romance comics from South Korea. That has a certain kind of gender dynamic, certain idea of beauty set. It's cartoons, right? But they do, you know, base their drawings on real people. And the K-pop look, I'm sure you understand what that means. In terms of beauty standards, is probably even more extreme than Bollywood. People are extremely unaccepting of anything that diverges from the K-pop beauty standards. And so Webtoons, in terms of how they draw their characters, really follows that particular K-pop visual aesthetic. And so this is something that people have complained about, and that a lot of queer and POC creators in the digital comic space have tried to push back against. But then if you look at what happens to them, they get people who draw characters who are dark-skinned, people who draw characters who are queer, but not in the acceptable sense of queer, in that it's not marketable, the unmarketable kind of queer, you know, the kind that can't be turned into a fetish, what I mean is. And people who draw people who are larger bodied, you know, particularly if you're a woman, it's an absolute crime to, you know, apparently be larger bodied in that kind of visual space, is that they get pushed to canvas. And eventually people get tired of it and they just want to migrate elsewhere. So there are other platforms that are set up for people to do things that, if you don't find success on Webtoons, you can go somewhere else. There are websites called Global Comics. There are a ton of other websites that try to copy the Webtoons kind of a business model. And these people have their own support. But the point is that in terms of the casual readers, they all flock to Webtoons because Webtoons, being a giant multinational corporation, has the money to advertise. And they advertise nonstop, and they're able to team up with Hollywood producers. And then there's a whole South Korean kind of a cultural machine that puts out all these K-dramas, and also based, some of them are based on Webtoons and the K-pop thing. So, like I said, you can't really discount the South Korean government initiative thing that comes part and parcel with the whole Korea Wave initiative. And that's why I pointed out, because this is what some countries are doing. You know, if other, if individuals want to fight back, it is actually very hard. And do I think that there should be some kind of institutionalized government support for creators who want to do things that are, you know, from a different country with different values? It's like, of course I do think that it should be. Right now there isn't, but I think pointing it out is important. So if you ask me, do I think that there is some ways to fight back a counterculture? Definitely that exists. That's always existed. But when you're up against some kind of hegemonic government initiative that has scores of money to pour into you, and they in South Korea they have organizations set up just for Webtoon creators. But even then, there's a lot of labor violations in the Webtoon space. So I don't want to sound like South Korean creators are doing so much better than other kinds of global creators on Webtoons, because they're not. They are also struggling as well. I think that when it comes to fighting these kinds of situations, government policy is very important. And people criticize neoliberalism because it's the idea of this small government is best government because the free market has to, you have to allow it to run rampant to do its thing. You know, that has proven to be a pretty much a failed ideology, and people, you know, people don't see it working for any longer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks. Do we have any more questions? No. Well, thank you so much for coming today. I hope you enjoyed the talk, and it was interesting.
Really, especially the comic strip, that was really like a creative culmination of your thesis, and I want to do something like that, make a documentary or a short video out of it. I like the way that you've creatively culminated your thesis. That was really nice.
Oh, thank you. I have to thank my artist, Angie Spice, who
I
did some. But the thing is, I had to focus on the programming, and I was able to hire a great artist who was able to bring forth my vision, so to speak. And she did a great job. And thanks to the Johnny Yang, the composer, you couldn't hear any of his background humbuzz, but you know, it's there. If you download the game from my website, then you can hear it.
Because you really had to learn a lot of this programming, right? I mean, yes. I remember when you were proposing this and how much you... Well, wondering how much you could outsource or work collaboratively with other people, but then you've done a lot of this learning yourself.
I had to, because the programming turned out to be much more expensive than I thought. Unity turned out to be a lot harder than I thought to learn as well. So in that case, I'm lucky in that I managed to make it work. I do have a little bit of programming background, so that's all kind of withered away now. So I'm not a complete beginner, but it made me realize that sometimes people start PhDs with the expectations that things will be easy in a particular area, and it turns out to be extremely hard. I think a lot of people have been through that. In retrospect, I wish I did not choose Unity, because there was a massive kind of hullabaloo issue with Unity, because apparently they tried to charge money for Unity about last year. So about year three of my PhD is like, Unity CEO decided to come out and say, I'm going to charge money for installation of Unity games. And there was a massive backlash, and so he backpedaled. But then it made me realize that Unity may be a free game engine in that you can download and use it for free, but it is not open source. And there are open source engines online like Godot. And Godot suddenly got a lot more popular because of Unity's crappy announcement. But then Godot is also a much less popular game engine, and so there's far fewer tutorials teaching you to use it. And it's just much harder to find help with Godot if you want to use it. And that is the problem with open source software. People who know how to program, open source is great. People who don't know, does it make that much difference? And so this is the sort of things that I struggled towards the end of my PhD when I realized the kind of situation I put myself in. But I think that is part of the whole process of research, is that someone needs to go there, and you know, I went there, I found out here are the problems, and could I have done things differently or better? Of course. But you know, you don't know that until you've actually gone out and tried to do it yourself.
Well done.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.